in association with iFanboy, welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. It's time for another Rucka debrief. That's right, writer Greg Rucka has joined us again, not only to celebrate the debut of his latest Queen and Country novel, The Last Run, but to answer some questions and some fan concerns, maybe, because it was earlier this year that Greg left DC after seemingly on a path to continue his critically acclaimed work on Batwoman with J.H. Williams. What changed? Greg addresses that and talks about some future projects. Plus, we open the forum as well to fan questions. We didn't get as far as we wanted to. Good news, though, it's going to be a two-part Rucka debrief, and we will pick up the conversation and questions on the next episode of Word Balloon. Greg's putting an end cap of sorts on his Queen and Country series with the latest novel, The Last Run. If you don't know the story, the book's jacket provides a good teaser. For nearly a decade, Tara Chase has been Britain's top covert agent. But she's past her expiration date, her body hurts, her nerves are scrambled. She's ready for a desk job. But before her replacement can be chosen, there's one last job for Queen and Country, and it may be the last thing she does ever. The assignment takes her to Iran, and the mission and story provide not only a crossroads for Chase, but for several other characters we've been following in Queen and Country for nearly a decade. Don't worry, more Word Balloon with Rucka coming up on the next episode as well of Word Balloon. Today it's sponsored by InStock Trades and InStockTrades.com, where you'll find a wide selection of trade paperbacks, hardcovers, absolute editions, omnibus editions, essentials, definitive editions, all at reduced rates off the standard retail price. And Queen and Country and Greg Rucka are well represented at InStockTrades.com. You can get each mission as a separate volume. On a standard retail price like Volume 7, Operation Saddlebags, featuring art from Mike Norton and Steve Ralston, the standard retail price is $14.95, but at InStockTrades.com, $10.47. How about the volumes of the Definitive Edition? There are four of them. The standard retail price for each is $19.95. At InStockTrades.com, just $13.97. Or if you're more interested in the writing process of Greg Rucka, how about the Queen and Country script book? Standard retail price, $15.95 at InStockTrades.com, just $11.97. Don't forget about their sister site, Discount Comic Book Service, DCBService.com, for all your monthly pre-order needs from the Diamond Catalog. You'll find amazing savings there waiting for you at both websites. Check it out for yourself. Go to Discount Comic Book Service at DCBService.com or InStockTrades at InStockTrades.com. Are you about to do a book tour?
Yeah, it's it is a it is what we call an abbreviated book tour. I'm going to hit a couple places up in Seattle. I'm going to be down to Houston. I'm going to hit Poison Pen in Scottsdale, Arizona, and I'm going to be in L.A. For the mystery bookstore in Westwood. And both Jen and I will be at the Miami International Book Fair near the end of November as well. Currently.
Cool.
Apparently, we're going to do a married couple in married couples in comics panel with Jimmy and Amanda.
Oh, that's great!
Yeah, that sounds kind of awesome to me.
Absolutely, and I would imagine the schedule is available at gregrucka.com.
Yeah, you go to gregrucka.com, and there's an appearances button, and if you press it, it tells you. And even my webmaster is this great guy. His name's Eric Newsom, and you go and you know on the listings, it's like he's hot linked each location, and there's a Google Maps link too. So you know,
oh wow,
you can put in how do I drive there? You know,
fantastic, excellent.
Yeah, we make it easy, and also. And actually, you know, I did a blog post about this today, but I'll abuse the privilege of talking to you to make a bully pulpit.
By all means.
But, you know, I'm hitting independent bookstores, and in particular mystery specialty bookstores. And people who want, you know, if you can't make it to the store, if, you know, for instance, you live in any of the cities that I'm not going to and you want a copy of the book and you want it signed or you want it personalized and you want one of the book plates that, you know, J.H. Williams III did, the book plate, because we've done a book plate for each Queen and Country novel. And he did a beautiful book plate, which you can also see at the website. And I'm going to have those with me at the signings as well. And if you want one of those, you know, there are two offers. You can buy the book, you send me a copy of your receipt, and I'll mail you a book plate. But if you, you know, buy through one of these stores, if you contact them and, you know, you give them whatever information saying, I want a copy of the book, I'll sign it for you at the store. I'll include a book plate. They will send it. So, and I urge people to do that. I really do urge people to support these stores.
Absolutely. I love the convenience of the internet, and I appreciate all everything that goes on because of it, but it's a shame that the ability to browse keeps disappearing, even in big cities.
Yeah, it really does. Well, and, you know, I mean, we're box stores are starting to die now, too.
Yeah.
You know, and I love Amazon for the convenience of Amazon, but there is nothing, you know, there's nothing like going into a specialty store. People know what they're talking about there, you know, and if you give them 5 minutes and you say, you know, these are my interests, these are my tastes, they will steer you right. They will put a book in your hand that you will have not found otherwise, and you will be glad you read. So.
And I should mention, InStockTrades.com is sponsoring this episode, and they are and they are both a specialty store and an online store. And
there you go.
And in fact, we talk about all of the comic graphic novels of Queen and Country and the definitive editions that are available through them.
Yeah.
So, but we're talking about the novel today. We're talking about The Last Run.
Yeah, and other things, I assume.
Absolutely. And thank you for the preview copy. I literally finished it today.
Okay,
and
that's a good thing.
And I'm happy and sad because it was another page-turner that I think all the novels and graphic novels have been. And I'm sorry that we're at an impasse. Or, you know, as you say, this is the end of Volume 1.
Yeah, this rounds out the first Queen and Country series and sets the stage for hopefully what will be the second. So.
Okay, and some questions are left hanging as to the fate of some characters.
Yes.
And I think that's, yeah. And because, you know, it reminds me, and I don't remember, and of course I'm sure you'll remember the exact episode name, but in the Sandbaggers, their final episode. Wasn't that their final episode, or was it the second series where things kind of changed? Well, things changed for the third season, because
they shuffled the status quo in the series a lot. I mean,
yeah.
the series ends on either a painful resolution or a shocking cliffhanger. Take your pick.
Right.
You know, the rumor in Sandbagger fan circles is that there was going to be a fourth series where Willie was going to be in a wheelchair. Oops, spoiler.
40-year-old series, it's all right.
Yeah.
35-year-old series.
Anyway, anybody who's listening and has, you know, you've done enough of these debriefs with me at this point. People who want to see the series have seen it, you know.
So. Sure. Well,
I can't imagine Willie in the wheelchair. There is a piece of me that's kind of grateful it didn't go that far.
But yeah, it's again, it's the wonder of losing certain characters, and there's just a big mystery at the end of Queen of Country in terms of what's next. But let's start with where things are, and that is Tara is, you know, has been a minder for about 10 years,
yeah.
and is kind of burnt out, as we see in the first. You know, chapter that we see here.
Yeah. I forget who I was talking to, but we were having a discussion about these are the kind of discussions I have. And I really wish I could remember who it was, because it was somebody who knew. But we were talking about the operational life of field agents. And he was saying, yeah, 3 years, you know, 3 years for the most before they're burnt. And they're burnt so thoroughly that, you know, they can't literally, you know, they fly into Istanbul and every security service in the world goes, oh, that's Phil from the CIA, you know, and
sure.
At which point their use as a covert operative is pretty much shot to hell. And one of the reasons why I went to Queen and Country novels, you know, and stopped with the comics was that I was wrestling with the problem of needing to tell stories that were fairly prescient. You know, they needed to be pretty tightly bound to the reality at the moment, with a certain amount of wiggle room of the period that I was writing. And the problem was that time was marching on. So, you know, Tara had to get older. Everybody had to get older. And this is, you know, this is the eternal series author's conflict. You know, do the characters age, and how do you deal with them aging? And how do you deal with it, quote-unquote, realistically? In Queen and Country, works very hard to have a sense of verisimilitude. You know, it needs to be believably our world in a way that, say, you know, if you're writing, you know, Batman, it doesn't.
Right.
And for that reason, age really does become an issue. So, you know, Tara, I was looking at the calendar. I was like, she would have been in Minder for just over 9 years, coming up on 10 years, and that's ridiculous. Never mind the physical toll, which is the, I think, the main issue that she's struggling with at the beginning of the book. But just from a practical intelligence gathering standpoint, after 9 years, and she's got a line to Crocker. She says, you know, if there's an intelligence service in the world that doesn't know who I am, it's because they're not bloody trying. And I think that was a fairly, you know, that's a fairly astute and fair observation. And in point of fact, it is actually one of the mechanisms of the book. I mean, she is, I don't want to say picked, but the fact that she is going to be the agent of record for this mission is accounted for by the opposition. You know, they are counting on it.
Everyone is counting on it. Not only her opposition, but also the CIA as well, and the special relationship that the two intelligence organizations have is obviously played out as it usually is in Queen and Country, and that's again part of the appeal. She's not Modesty Blaise. She's not James Bond. She is, you know, a real person, and also she's a mother.
Yeah.
And you know, and you know, there's you know, each book since she's given birth, it has been that motherhood that has kind of dragged her back to, when is this going to stop?
Yeah.
And there's a little girl that's counting on her.
Yeah, I think the stuff with Tamsin, and there's not a lot of it in the book, but I think that Tamsin is such a presence in everything that Tara does in the novel, in the same way that Tom is.
Yes.
Frankly. You know, but like I said, it was, it's interesting because I did Walking Dead, and a lot of what Walking Dead was for Atticus was sort of closure at the end of this very long journey. And there was an element of aging and needing to resolve that for him as well.
Mm-hmm.
Where am I now versus where did I come from and how have I changed and what do I think of who I've become? And then, you know, I guess in its own way, the last run is very much echoing some of those themes, which I suppose says something about what I've been doing of late as well, sort of going
well, 40 now. Yeah, there is kind of a coincidence that we are almost on 10 years for, you know, slightly more for you, but not too far from what Tara's gone through. And, yeah, Atticus's career path as well. When you say Walking Dead for people who are listening that don't know about...
No, not the fine Kirkman work. This was the last Kodiak novel. It's called Walking Dead.
Absolutely.
As opposed to The Walking Dead.
Yes.
So.
But, again, yeah, it's interesting, Greg, because your two characters that you have carried in novels are reaching these kind of, you know, in the case of Tara, you know, let's just say, a turning point.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's weird. You know, there's whenever you talk about the new book, there's that question of how much do you talk about, you know, with regards to the plot. You don't want to give spoilers away.
Right.
I think we can talk about the setup and not need to fear that too much because, you know, if you can't read the first, it's only the first 30 pages, you know?
No, I understand. And the other thing, too, is, and maybe because, again, of your influences, it's Paul Crocker's story as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I love Paul Crocker. And it's, you know...
Well, but that's always been Queen and Country.
Yes.
Queen and Country has always been about the relationship, you know, between D-Ops and this particular Minder especially. But, you know, and all of the novels have honored that. Crocker is as important a character in these stories as Tara is. And considering how stormy their relationship has been, especially given the last two novels, I felt it was kind of important to get some closure there too.
And Paul is at a crossroads as well because
let's be honest, Paul passed the crossroads a long time ago.
He is running on fumes, literally.
Well, and he's running out of road.
Yeah.
You know?
And that's the thing, and it's that human aspect to an espionage story that I think the Queen of Country series always brings, and that he is very much a protector of his minders in the field, and is always ready to buck the system and his masters. And the great thing is about this op in particular is that takes place in Iran. The signs are there that this is a setup. As you say, the opposition wants Tara Chase there. It's just too convenient. It's too tempting of a prospective Iranian, a key figure in the Iranian hierarchy that is out there and supposedly is ready to be pulled in and defect or whatever the equivalent is.
Yeah, lifted, I think. They think they're going in for a lift. But, you know, it's interesting because, perhaps it's interesting, I should say. You know, Crocker has always been consistent in that no matter how much of a bastard he is, his behavior is always governed by his desire to protect his agents. One of the things that I'm very fond of in the last run, and I'm not sure this is a giveaway to fans, but Crocker finally has, you know, and we've seen him, you know, 10 years of series and novels and comics, but he finally has a moment in the last run where not only does he get the operation to go the way he wants, but it executes the way he wants. And that's actually pretty rare. I mean, I don't think we saw that ever in the series. You know, there is a turning point in the book where he basically gets control and gets to do things his way. And that was very satisfying to write for him, actually.
Very cool. And it's everybody's role. I mean, that's the thing. Everyone is ready to kind of move on. Everyone is kind of, you know, Nicky Poole is ready to move up.
Chris.
And yeah, Langford is ready to, I mean, everyone is ready to kind of move on, but everyone is still kind of stuck where they are too, and you can feel the confines. And also, you see this on the, in some ways, I guess, on the Iranian side as well.
Yeah. I mean, that's very intentional.
Sure, and I mean it's always an education reading these books because I think we get an idea of how things work, you know, with some artistic license, I'm sure, but you know how things work. You know, in the meeting rooms, because it is in James Bond. The realities of espionage are much more complicated, and it is fighting your own government to do the right thing.
Espionage is always, always, always political. It's always political. And in fiction, espionage is almost never political. James Bond is very rarely political. You know, even the Bourne stuff is not really political. And the Bourne movies in particular, you know, bow much more to a sense of realism within the apparatus of espionage, I guess. But even then, they're not truly political. I mean, the issues of real-world politics do not come to bear. And you know, that was something that McIntosh did in The Sandbaggers that made me fall in love with The Sandbaggers. And even Le Carré never really, with Smiley, never really jumped into bed and pulled the covers up with regards to that. There would be references to higher government. There would be references to the prime minister. But you would never actually see that hand, you know, and these spy agencies, at least in the Western world, are tools of government as opposed to, say, the government, the further east you go.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, and again, back to the special arrangement, you know, things have changed. Angela Chung is a very different CIA liaison to Paul Crocker than Julian is.
Yeah. Seal is a very, very different guy. And Angela, and that was another thing, you know, I wanted to sort of indicate that Angela's relationship with Crocker was actually a very unique relationship. You know, Seal and Crocker aren't friends, and Angela and Crocker were.
And two, it's that You know, it usually is, and we, I think, because we live in the United States, I don't think we sometimes realize the back seat that, you know, England and Great Britain has to take, you know, yeah. in a lot of, you know, world decisions. We saw it to a degree, I think, in the Iraq War.
You saw actually in the election, right? And there was an Obama quote about a year or so ago where I think he used an indefinite article to describe the special relationship. I think he called it a special relationship, and that threw in England, that was news. That was a big deal. Is that the Obama administration saying that we no longer have a place of prominence? We are no longer the special relationship. We are just a valued ally, not the valued ally.
Interesting.
And that, I mean, it really was. There was a little flurry about it, and very quickly the State Department stepped in and said, that's the special relationship. And so you can sort of hear a collective sigh of relief from Whitehall, you know, going, all right then.
Did you see that... Dennis Quaid, it's the guy who played Frost, and who played
Tony Blair.
Thank you, Tony Blair. I'm thinking Tony Robbins. Wrong guy.
Yeah.
Wrong
no,
Tony.
I haven't seen it. I know what you're talking about. And no, I haven't seen. You know, this is. I remain the guy I am. I watch like four things regularly. You know, I watch the new Doctor Who season. I watched Sherlock because, you know, you can have Joss Whedon. Stephen Moffat is my master now.
I understand. I watched Study in Pink last night, too. It was amazing.
I think Study in Pink is, you know, speaking as a Holmes fan, I thought Study in Pink was masterful. It's funny, I saw Dwayne Szczesny. I can never pronounce his last name right, at BoucherCon like 2-3 weeks ago. And he's a huge Holmes fan. And I was like, have you seen these? You have to see these. The reverence with which they treat the source material and yet the deftness with which they modernized it. And also Martin Freeman, I thought was fabulous as Watson. I think
completely
the casting
agree.
Of that was... We've just digressed, but if you haven't seen Sherlock, see it. It's like on Masterpiece Theater right now. Or
yeah, and it
no
was on my list.
Called Masterpiece Theater, I guess it's called Masterpiece Mystery.
Yes, it was on my list of things we had to talk about. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But no, I thought the first one was excellent. I thought the third one was excellent. I thought the second one was okay. It's got to be blindingly difficult to write 90 minutes, you know, of that quality consistently. I do not begrudge anybody for struggling with that material.
Which is why I think there was only three. I mean, it's so funny. Connor Kilpatrick from iFanboy and I were tweeting back and forth last night, and he's like, I wish an American television network had licensed this. And I said, what's wrong with PBS? And he goes, that doesn't count. And I'm like, dude, no over-the-air network is interested in three 90-minute movies.
No.
I'm like, it's not worth the money. And he's like, well, they've got to change the way they do business. And I completely agree with him. But I'm like, that's just not the reality of network TV. And I don't even know if the basic channels, if it's worth the money.
But you are seeing it. I mean, you are seeing it. You look and you see we're getting smaller, higher quality seasons away from, you know, the core networks. You know, Mad Men had a short season. Breaking Bad runs these very tight seasons. Leverage, very tight seasons. You know, Leverage is going, what, I think 13? I think maybe they're going 16 this year. And 16's a lot.
Well, 16's closer to a traditional American television thing. And I'll even give you 13. But we're talking 3 and 390. And everyone hates 90 minutes except for the Brits.
Yeah, well,
which I have no problem with, but I think they go crazy if they've got a 90-minute thing they've got to put in that 3-hour time, you know, a block of prime time.
Well, but that's exactly what would happen if you put it on American television. They go, it's 90 minutes. Let's make it 3 hours with a lot of ads.
I was going to say, with commercials, they probably would make it 2 hours or 3 hours. Of course they would.
But my understanding is, I think they're doing. I heard somewhere they're doing another 6.
Sure. Sure. Well, that's usually, you know, that's typical British TV.
Yeah.
You try it out with 3 or 6, and then if it's a success, then you give them a couple more episodes.
Yeah, well, and I mean, I'm not, I've never worked for the BBC. I have no idea what their scheduling is like. But it does seem that they have a more generous sense of pace, you know, that will allow work to be ready, as opposed to saying, no, it's ready by this date or it isn't.
Sure.
But again, I could be entirely, you know, I could be high. I don't know. I freely admit I don't know what I'm talking about there.
Well, back to
I will say I thought the Sherlocks were wonderful, and I hope they do more. So
here, here. All right, back to the special relationship because
because we were talking about fake Brits.
Yeah, and your book. So let's stop promoting other people's products. We'll promote The Last Run. No, this is it is the special relationship that is a key part of this story as well.
Yeah,
and it is, you know, again, they all feel like they're being set up, and the CIA doesn't care. They see the bait, and they see the, you know, the excitement. And
I'm not sure that that's fair to Julian and so on. You know, the thing about Julian Seal, who in the novel is the CIA station chief in London and is the liaison with Crocker, is that Angela would, you know, Julian's predecessor would come to Crocker and say, look, this is the party line, this is the political situation, and it's a big shit sandwich, and we all have to take a bite, and I'm sorry, but that's the way it is. And in that sense, she was a little more grown up than Crocker, because Crocker would stomp his feet and say, it's not fair, it's not fair, it's not right, and Angela would say, grow up. You know, it's espionage.
Right.
Get a grip. And Julian to me was always far more aware. Julian was governed by something that an old friend of mine said. He's with the State Department, and it was something he told me that actually influenced the novel Before the Last Run, the Queen and Country novel before it, Private Wars, which was one of the reasons that State Department officers do very limited tours is that, for lack of a better phrase, they don't want them going native. So that, you know, to work in a foreign embassy or whatnot, you have to be culturally open. You need to be able to learn, what's going on in the land you are in. And you need to be able to put yourself, if you're going to do the job right, to put yourself in the place of those people, right?
Right.
And the trick and the danger, and I use danger loosely, is that if you stay too long, you run the risk of putting their needs before your own
right.
country's needs. And Julian, to me, was always governed by the fact that, you know what, yeah, it sucks, but my job is to serve the U.S. My job is not to make Paul Crocker happy. My job is not to make SIS happy. My job is to do what the CIA needs me to do on behalf of the president and people of the United States of America. And for that reason, Julian is always much more protective of American interests overtly. And I don't think Angela was any less protective of American interests, but she was, shall we say, She knew how to work with Crocker much better. And I think she was far more sympathetic to the human cost.
Yes.
And Seal is, you know, one of the...
More by the book.
And one of the things that is presented, you know, I think a couple of people pointed out to Crocker in The Last Run, they basically say, look, you've been a great DOS, but politically, you're a fuck-up. I mean, you are a political car crash. You have no idea how to make friends or exchange favors. You don't. And that is, I think, a fair assessment of Crocker versus Seal, who is far more politically astute. So.
No, I understand. It's a page turner, and it's
well, good.
And, no, it really is, and it was really easy. I got the book. Was it last Friday that I got it? I mean, I got no, but it's been about a week. But yeah. I mean, I was able to, you know, I got through it very quickly when I was able to actually, you know, find time to read.
Yeah, I got actually somebody had posted to my website tonight saying, I got it last night. I meant to read like the first 20 pages, and I finished it at 2 in the morning. To which I have yet to respond, but good. That's my, you know, my feeling is that is the ideal situation with a novel frankly, the ideal situation with anything I write, is that you're going to want to sit down and know how it ends. So.
Absolutely. And it's and it really also would play well as I think, good travel reading. I mean, that's the other thing, too. I mean, it's and thriller novels, I think, are kind of built for that audience.
Yeah, no, it's a good airplane book.
Yeah, honestly, I mean that in the best possible way, because, I mean, that's the thing. There's a lot here, but it moves quickly. And also, I was surprised it did end under 300 pages. And I was, you know, I mean, I can appreciate the story. It doesn't seem like you left anything other than obvious possible future ramifications because of the ending,
yeah,
you know, unsettled and everything. I mean, it seemed like it was a little smaller than the.
It's lean. It's funny because, and again, it's something I did with the last Kodiak novel with Walking Dead, which was, and I don't know if it's a product again of age or simply stylistically trying to adjust myself, but, and I don't think I've ever, you know, I mean, nobody can accuse me of writing florid prose. I've never been a big over writer, and I've never. I've never really fallen in love with how pretty can I make my language. I want the language to serve the story, and I want the story to be clean. But with the last two novels in particular, I really have gone to great lengths to pare down to the essentials. I really wanted them to be books that you picked it up, you opened it, you read page one, and that was the starting gun. And it was, you went. You know, these are go. They're not designed to be books as you, oh, I shall read a couple chapters tonight, and then I'll get back to it in a week. These were very, very intentionally crafted to be lean, mean, sharp, quick reads. So I am somewhat pleased to hear that it worked.
So Atticus is now wrapped up. Tara, you know, and Queen, let's say Queen and Country is in a specific place right now. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what, and you've, you know, you closed the door at DC.
Mm-hmm.
And so what?
I wouldn't say I closed the door so much as I left.
Okay.
But I think the door, well, you know, I got a text from Dan DeDeal like 3-4 weeks ago basically saying, hey, how you doing? And specifically, I want you to know the door's still open. You know, to which I was like, hey, great to hear from you.
Okay.
And you know where I am. Yeah. You know.
Okay. But, well, what's in your immediate future in terms of, I mean, obviously you've got the tour for Queen and Country, but,
yeah.
and believe me, I don't mean to push you right in front of the typewriter again or the word processor.
I actually am sitting down to, the last couple months have been research for the new novel, which is, new character, new series, new publisher, new editor, new everything. I just signed a contract, with Little Brown. I'm going to be published, under the Mulholland Books imprint. My editor is a guy named John Schoenfelder, who's fantastic. I think I'm in love. I owe him a novel, and I want to get it to him in a timely fashion, but the research on this one has been sort of busting my hump. And doing it in a different way. You know, you do research for something like Last Run, and, okay, Iran. Well, there's so much research you're going to be able to get, but my ability to go to Tehran is somewhat limited, and so a lot of the research for The Last Run was library research, was internet research, was interview research, but it was there was no on the ground. You know, the best I could get was YouTube video. And poring over maps, you know, online and in the library, like I said. And for this new one, Alpha, it is set in a fictional location, but the fictional location is, wow, this is going to sound so vague. It's it is the equivalent of saying I'm setting it in a fictional international airport, but it's an international airport. So everybody who reads the frickin' book knows what an international airport is like. And they have an idea of how it works. And they have an idea of what they can expect when they go to a major international airport.
Mm-hmm.
that's the easy research. The more difficult research is all the stuff that you don't see behind the, you know, admittance-only doors. And that is, in large part, some of the research I'm struggling with. And in a similar way as saying, in a post-9/11 world, if you were to write a novel about an international airport, you would have difficulty accurately portraying all of the security mechanisms in place for obvious reasons.
Sure.
I am running into exactly the same problem with this particular paradigm. So that has been its own challenge.
What was your thing back in the day when you went into a police station and you wanted to know how a drug deal would work or whatever? What was
they love it when you walk in like that. Actually, it actually goes pretty well. If you can get past the first, they stare at you with the hairy eyeball. Cops love to talk about stuff. I mean, one of the best, most educational research things I ever did was I had a college friend whose brother was NYPD. And his brother put us in his car, not a police car, went unmarked, and we drove around Spanish Harlem. And he would get out, and this was his neighborhood. This was the guy's beat. And we would go into the unlicensed social clubs, and he'd point people out. He'd say, that guy is selling dope, and this guy, we rousted. And you get to see all the stuff that you just never see because you're driving past. You're not looking at it.
Right.
So, this research is a little different because the fictional location has a real-world analog. And I, for both legal reasons and dramatic reasons, don't want to be revealing those secrets.
So, sure, okay.
I'm having to be somewhat circumspect in the research as well. And that's all secondary to the plot, right? Because now it's also, okay, that's all good. But this is a whole new series, so I've got the main character, I've got Jad, the guy's name is Jonathan Bell, but now it's, you know, create all the other characters and bio all the other characters and set up all the other characters, and then we need the order of action. So how is the new novel going to work? So I suspect I will begin writing it probably Monday or Tuesday. I suspect it will begin at the beginning of November. And then, you know, for me, the novel writing process is a fairly quick process if I've done all my homework. Because at that point, I know everything I'm going to do. It's a question of how fast can I type. And I can type really fast. So, you know, all goes well, we should have a draft by the beginning of December.
Wow.
And if all goes really well, it will be a strong draft and won't require too much heavy lifting to fix. But, you know, I don't like first drafts. First drafts annoy me. First drafts to me are always the process of, okay, let's get the idea out. And I think that's one of the reasons why I type so fast, is that I want it out. Because once the idea is out, then I can start really crafting it. You know, then you can go in and take all of the fine tools to it, and, you know, shave bits and sand bits and polish bits and take a look at it as a whole. It's the difference between, you know, the idea is this manifest, it's this imagination, indistinct thing in your head, and then when you have a draft, it has form, and it may not be the final form. And God knows, you know, if you talk to any writer who says, yes, it's perfect, they're lying, and you should run away from them. But, you know, the difference between the first draft and the second draft is once the first draft's out, you can actually get to work. You can make it good. One of the worst things, and frankly one of the reasons why I walked away from D.C., is that almost everything I had turned in was first draft writing, and I hated it. I hated the fact that the deadlines had become so tight. I had become a big fireman at D.C. You know, people would call me and say, can you grab this book for a while? This person dropped out on us. Will you take over on this?
Sure. That happened in Supergirl. That happened World of New Krypton.
It happened on Action. It happened on World of New Krypton. I mean, there's a long list of it. And the problem with that is, you know, and it's the nature of that publishing mechanism. The book has to come out. And you've got an editor, you know, even the best editors saying, Greg, I need a script. I need pages. The artist has to get drawing. And the second you're in a position where you have to write pages as opposed to a script, you are in a position where you cannot rewrite. Because as soon as you've sent six pages off to the artist, well, those six pages, you're already running late.
Right.
So the artist isn't going to be able to redraw if you screwed up. You know? And I hated that. I hated it. You know, and I think, honestly, you can tell the difference. You look at, and there's stuff that, you know, I'm very proud of, but I think you can look at my body of work and you can be like, this is polished and this is not. This is work where he had time and this is work where he didn't. And I think that shows, and I think the audience deserves better. And I think I deserve better, you know. And that's not me, and I hasten to say this. This is not me going, curse you, D.C. This isn't D.C.'s fault, you know. Ultimately, I could have said, you know what, I know you need it quickly. I'm not going to take the job. I took the job. It was my, you know, it was my responsibility. Nobody put a gun to my head and said, you have to write this fast. But the problem is that when you're in that environment, it also becomes very difficult to see that there is another way. You know?
Sure.
That becomes your life. And when it becomes your life, it's very difficult to sort of look up and go, oh, hey, wait, I don't have to work like this. It's going to require a radical change, but I don't have to work like this.
So moving forward, do you see, you know, I mean, as far as future comic work?
Well, let's see, you know, I got the first batch of thumbnails on Stumptown 5 from Southworth today.
Okay.
I'm going over those tomorrow with James Lucas Jones. And actually, just before you called, I got an email from Matthew saying the second batch would be with me tomorrow. So I really don't ever want to have a publishing delay like we had between Stumptown 3 and Stumptown 4 again.
Understood.
To such an extent that James Lucas and I have an agreement in place, which is we are not soliciting the next arc of Stumptown until there are four issues in the can and there are five issues in the arc.
Understood.
I'm not going to do that. I you know, I hate it when it's done to me. You know, I hate it when I go to the store, you know, on the third week of the month expecting the next issue of whatever, and I'm told, no, it's not here. I just think it's a shabby way to treat your readership. And frankly, I don't have the, for lack of a better net, lack of a better phrase, the safety net of a 70-year legacy character to fall back upon.
Sure.
So if my issue's not there, you know, I'm losing people.
Absolutely. No, I understand.
I mean, it's bad business, and it's a bad way to treat your fans. So, and Matthew and James and I are all on the same page about this. So, you know, we know what the next arc is. We're working on the next arc. It's called The Case of the Baby in the Velvet Case, just to make things really confusing. It'll be five issues, and we will have gotten our publishing sizes ironed out. I think we're doing 22 or 24-page issues. And that's it. It's not going to be any more of these. This issue is 31 pages, but this issue is 28. It will be consistent.
Okay.
It will be, and when it comes, it will be timely. So, and I'm working on something else, but the other thing I am working on is so far off. The only thing I can say about it is I'm working on something else.
Okay.
It is literally from this point at least 18 months away from seeing print.
So comics in the new future would be the Stumptown next arc eventually,
mm-hmm.
and then this nebulous 18 months in advance project.
Yeah, and Matthew Clark and I have been discussing a project, but again, it's amorphous, and I don't... The other thing I've learned is I don't want to talk about projects until I can actually say, and it will be out on this date.
Understood. Well, and again, yeah, based on, well, you know, what the current experience was with Stumptown, I understand.
Mm-hmm.
One of the questions we got from the iFanboy crowd, they wanted to know when the Stumptown hardcover is coming out.
I don't know when the trade is coming out.
Okay.
In all honesty, I suspect it will be in the next 2 months, but I could be wrong about that. Once I have a date, I will loudly proclaim it on Twitter and Facebook and my website and the Oni website, and frankly, I'll probably stand on my roof with a megaphone and just say, buy it! but we've been talking about back matter and value-added content for it. Now we've been going back and forth, you know, do we want to reprint the essays that were in, you know, that Matthew wrote at the end of the first four issues, or do we want those to stand for the first four issues and put in other back matter? James Lucas had actually proposed doing sort of a roundtable interview with Matthew and myself and him sort of talking about it and maybe putting that in.
Cool.
And doing some other things like that. So that's, you know, it, there will be more Stumptown, but again, I'm not going to solicit that puppy until we can hit every date that we say we're shooting for.
I know other authors like Brad Meltzer kind of, you know, go back and forth where, you know, they spend a year on a novel and then they spend a year writing comics and then it's back to the next novel. Do you see yourself kind of going to that kind of rhythm?
No, I don't have the luxury that Brad does.
Okay.
I don't make his money.
Understood.
I mean, I simply don't. So, you know, I need to, certainly at this point, I need to write the novels. And I want the comics to be out, and I would like to have more material out. But it's like I said earlier, you know, I want to do a new Queen and Country series. You read the last run, ostensibly, you know, ostensibly that's why we're talking.
Right.
The last run ends in a very specific place to set up a new status quo for a series two.
Right.
I have the characters. I know who these people are. I have an idea for what the first operation is. But I ain't going to write that thing until I have the time to write it well, and I ain't going to bang it out. And again, there's another issue actually there, which is I've been talking to James and Oni about how we would do that. Do we do it as an OGN? Do we do it as an ongoing? Do we do it as an ongoing but with downtime, ostensibly like we wanted Stumptown to be?
Sure.
And I was breaking this thing, and I realized I don't want to do it as an OGN. I love the form, but OGNs do not allow for the same sort of episodic plot break that you get in an issue. You know, issues lend themselves to cliffhangers simply by their nature.
Certainly.
And I think for Queen and Country, much in the same way with Stumptown, that's kind of crucial, that sense of rising and falling tension and being able to ramp things up. So,
do you want to keep switching off with other novels as well down the line as opposed to comics for Queen and Country?
I don't know what's going to happen with Q&C novels. I really don't. I honestly don't know. I like writing these characters in novel form. I like the opportunity to sort of, you know, if you're doing a 24-page comic, you are, I don't want to say limited, but the medium has restrictions on the amount of time you can spend on certain things.
Certainly.
And one of the luxuries of writing a Queen and Country novel is I can spend more time on details. I can talk more about... You learn more about Crocker in the novels than you ever did in the series.
No question. With the exception of Declassified, maybe, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Declassified, you meet his wife. In the novels, you meet his kids.
This is true.
You know. Yeah. And there are people who go, he has kids? Yes, he has two. You know, and I like that, and I like being able to do that. So I can certainly see doing more Queen and Country novels once the second series gets going. But again, there are so many variables involved, and it's like being asked, are you going to write any more Kodiak? You know, there's some really cool stuff going on with Kodiak right now. You know, hopefully I'll be able to talk about that in the next couple weeks.
Oh, great.
But there's some really exciting stuff that's developing there. And if it goes through, I would be an idiot not to write another Kodiak novel. And I, you know, half your audience said, well, you're an idiot, you know. But so, yeah, Walking Dead took Atticus to a place where he could reasonably say, I am done now. And, you know, my initial thought had been, I actually am going to let him lie. You know, my thought, if I did another sort of Kodiak world novel, it would be a Bridget novel. And it would be a novel where Bridget ends up having to call Atticus and saying, I have a problem and I need you to come and shoot them. To which Atticus would say, I'm going to put Elena on because I think that's much more entertaining, frankly, considering how much they hate each other. So, you know, the potential is always there, but right now the novels are, there are three novels planned right now with this new guy, with Jad.
Okay.
And I'm excited about those, and those I really want to write. So I suspect that I'm going to write those next. Those are probably the next priority on the novel front. And while I'm doing that, you know, there's this amorphous 18 months out project that I'm going to continue to write ahead on, and other things as they come.
Okay. Well, let's talk
terribly,
about...
Terribly mysterious and unsatisfying, I know.
No, that's, you know, that's fine. And no, I understand. That's all right.
Well, and, you know, we haven't even talked about it. There was a preview up on the blog. People were calling it Gowanus when it went up, and that's actually not what it's called. But Rick Burchett and I are trying to do this thing called American Soldier.
Okay, I wasn't sure if we could talk about that. Let's talk about American Soldier.
Yeah, we can. But the problem there entirely, and frankly... I don't know who might be listening to this, but hey, if you want to talk to me, please do. We're trying to find a publisher, and the problem is it's a lot of work to ask Rick to do on spec. And, you know, we've had some interest from some folks, but they've got to be able to write a check enough that will allow him to do the writing.
Okay.
To do the art. So... You know, we're still trying to figure out where that's going to end up. We wanted to find a home, but that project's not dead by any stretch. It's just, it is one of those things that I cannot in good conscience say, well, yes, I know you have paying work, Rick, but work on this instead.
Is that...
They'll say, hi, want to eat.
I don't know where the new DC Entertainment status quo is with original creator-owned material. Is that something you could, you know, take to them and say, hey...
I have no idea. To me, it's very important to be able to retain rights. I do not like the fact that unless you are in very rarefied air, and I mean very rarefied air, the stuff that you create for a company like DC or Marvel, they take at least 50% of. And in many cases, they have deals that, you know, protect their interests. But by protecting their interests, they're not really beneficial to a creator. You know, my arrangement with Oni is a very good arrangement for me. I am allowed to sell media rights. I am allowed to work with them very actively. And I'm not sure I can get that kind of deal from, you know, a DC or a Marvel or a Dark Horse.
Okay.
That's not to say that I would say no if somebody came along and said, yes, we will do that deal with you. But frankly, I think American Soldier is also, it's a very different kettle of fish. And I'm not sure any of those companies would be interested in it.
Okay. I wanted to, because I know we're coming on an hour, and I want to be able to talk more with you if we can tomorrow.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, but let me.
John, it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
And likewise, my friend, and I appreciate that. But I let me throw in a couple more questions because they involve some things that, you know, wrapped up this year. You know, I can't help but think of our last conversations in 2009 where you were very excited about the direction that Batwoman was going into.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously something changed that made you decide to walk away.
Yeah.
One person asks, Patman 2 from iFanboy asks, with J.H. Williams continuing Batwoman's story, and the fact, too, that he did these faceplates for you for the book plates,
yeah,
and everything, is he going to be using plot points that the two of you talked about when you were still writing the series, or do you think he'll be doing his own thing and leaving some stuff out should you ever decide to return to the character?
Well, there are two things there. I mean, the first is, actually, there's a couple things. My relation, you know, my leaving DC has no bearing at all on my relationship with Jim. JH remains to this day one of the best people I've ever had the honor of meeting and working with in the industry. I think he's unfairly talented, you know? And he's a good guy. So, I mean, he and I, we're friends. We get along.
Cool.
As far as plot goes, you know, he and I had really only broken one further story beyond what we had done. We had broken the next Alice story.
Uh-huh.
But the other thing to remember is that J.H. isn't working alone. He's working with Hayden Blackman. And Hayden, who, if he ever hears this, will probably be shocked, but I'm actually a fan of his work. So, you know, Jim, there were three people who created Kate, ultimately, the Kate that finally made it to the page in Detective. And those three people were me, Mike Seglain, and J.H. Williams. And she can't be in better hands. You know, I mean, she really can't. I do not worry for her. I frankly worry, in as much as I can worry, I worry far more for the fate of Renee than I worry about the fate of Kate. I have no question at all about Jim's and Hayden's ability to tell good stories with that, you know, with Batwoman, and to make those stories that are stories that I want to read. So,
okay.
Does that answer the question?
I think so.
I tend to ramble on questions like this. I never know. Did I answer it, or did I just go off on a tangent?
No, I think that works. That's fine. We saw in I Am an Avenger a reunion of sorts. It's a short story, but the Captain America story, or I should say the Steve Rogers story.
Yeah, I guess we can't call him Captain America. So
yeah, he's always Captain America. Who are we kidding?
Yeah.
Whatever outfit they put him in, that's all right. But no, it was really cool seeing you and Stefano and Michael get together for this little shorty.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. That was a lot of fun.
And I know people were like, obviously we're going to be seeing more Marvel work from Greg, because clearly there was an opportunity to do this story.
Mm-hmm.
And your response to that supposition is?
Oh, the question is, are we seeing more Marvel work from me?
Yes.
Potentially, I don't know.
Okay.
I've been talking to Steve Wacker. You know, Wacker is he's one of those editors that I would probably throw myself in front of a bus for if I had to, and if there was nobody else I could push in the way, and if he wouldn't get out of the way himself. He earned a very special place in my heart during 52, and he's dangled something in front of me that is so thorny it's becoming appealing. If that makes sense. He's basically put a character in front of me and said, this character in this setting, and my first response was, you're out of your mind, it doesn't work. And then he came back and he said, but it could. And so I've been going, maybe. There is other work I have to do, and nothing is set in stone yet. I'm in no position to say no. But, you know, the reasons that I stepped away from DC are the same reasons that would keep me from jumping into the sack with Marvel.
Sure.
I needed to put my own work first. And taking on any work for, you know, the major comic book publishers right now, it's very shiny. And they pay good money, and it's exciting to write stuff that Wonder Woman says, or that Captain America says, sorry, Steve Rogers says, and that can be blindingly attractive. And I need to remind myself, I've promised myself I'm going to do these things. So it is dictated as much by the opportunities they present as much as the opportunities that I'm pursuing. And that's kind of vague. So I suppose the very short answer is there's a possibility that I would do more work with Marvel. I would do more work with Michael in a heartbeat. You know, he is, like J.H., just one of the finest collaborators I've had the privilege of working with. And just doing that little story reminded me how much I adored working with him. So
very cool. Well, and that's good. So then it is fair to suppose that it's not a beyond the monthly constraints of the editorial need of, you know, the script's got to be in. You know, you're not through with comics. You're not through with superheroes.
Oh, God, no. But see, I was never through with it.
I
mean, this is the thing. People, you know, there's a lovely amount of supposition that flies around.
Right.
And, you know, and in the absence of facts, you know, we will default to fiction. And the other thing is that, you know, the comics industry is an industry where, like entertainment, everybody needs to be an insider. You know, everybody has to know what's going on behind the scenes, and
right.
they don't. You know, I was
right.
at DC for nearly a decade, and there was stuff going on there that I never knew about. You know, there was stuff going on in books. I never knew about it. You know, and I would hear on the Internet, oh, it was this happened, and I'd be like, no, it didn't. I mean, it just didn't. That just never happened.
Right.
So, you know, look, I'm a fan of comics. It's hard to be a fan of comics and not be a fan of superheroes.
Sure.
And, you know, I love these characters. There are characters that I would return to in a heartbeat, I think. But as I said, that's a shiny bauble, and whenever it's presented, I have to stop myself and go, okay, before you grab the shiny, remember the reasons that you stepped away. And I suppose, I don't know, I don't want it to sound selfish or self-important, but it really is, you know, I had hit a point where I needed to work on the stuff that was my stuff. And one of the things that I think is going on, as we see more and more synergy between comics publishing and, you know, movies, is that the opportunity to do your stuff is harder and harder to achieve now. These are properties that are worth more now than they ever have been to their owners. And they are R&D investments now more than they ever have been
sure.
to their owners. And for that reason, if none other, they are being governed by committee more than ever before. And that makes it hard, for instance, to pursue one's own vision. There are people who can do it. You know, Grant Morrison is one of the greatest writers I think comics has ever seen. The luxury of that is that he is given the room to run. There aren't a lot of Grants out there, which is probably good because we'd all be broke. but you see what I mean?
Understood. Yeah,
but,
sure.
You know, there are people who can steer the boat, and then there are people who have to row. And there's nothing wrong with having to row. But sometimes you want to go off in your own little dinghy, I guess.
No,
to just totally destroy the metaphor.
But I also see other people pursuing their own things and reaping the benefits from it. And, you know, you've had some, you know, success with that, with Whiteout. Mm-hmm. And you know, the fact that it got made at all. Obviously,
yeah.
speaks to that,
yeah.
And you know, I mean, that's the and there are other stories that, you know, obviously, I mean, Queen and Country, you know, clearly would be a wonderful series. You know, Sandbagger fans alone, I think, would give you a nice base to start with.
One would think so,
but truly, and that's the thing. So, no, that's good. I mean, I think that's great. I think there's room for both, and it's good. You know, again, I think. We, you know, based on our conversations, I knew you weren't done, but I, other people probably have these questions, and that's why
yeah.
it's
no. And I think honestly that the undue delay between Stumptowns 3 and 4 came at a time when it was like, oh my God, he is done. Where did he go? And you know, the nature of comics is such that it's a monthly medium, if not a weekly one. And if you're not in the store, you know, people are going to go, where'd he go?
Right.
So, no, I'm still here. one of the things,
sure.
I say it with tongue half in cheek, but one of the things that I've actually had to grapple with, this is going to sound remarkably personal, and I suppose somewhat silly to some people, but there's an issue of vanity. You know, that was a real hard thing for me to go, I'm going to walk away from this limelight, this DC limelight, you know, that I get to share. And I'm gonna move off into the shadows because that's really where I moved. And that was another thing I really had to grapple with when I was trying to make my own decisions. You know, do I want to step away from that? Comics is a very small pool. It really is. It's a very tiny pond. You know, when our best-selling book in this industry sells 120,000 copies, that's tiny.
Yep.
Compared to every other entertainment industry out there, that's minuscule. But when you're in that tiny pond, you can feel like a very big fish. And that's a nice feeling. That's a very nice feeling. So it is, you know, it did give me some pause, I must admit. The thought of if I go away, do I cease to exist, sort of thing. So,
well, I'm glad you poked your head out to say hello, and we'll continue. and this is
don't make me regret that I said that. I'm sure this is one of those things where people listening are gonna be like, oh man.
No, you know, Ethan Van Sciver made the point of you know, saying that if you're not working for DC and Marvel but still working in comics, it's, you know, there are enough stores that don't support, and forgive the phrase, but second tier or third tier publishers. And it is kind of an out of sight, out of mind, where, oh, I didn't realize so-and-so was still working. And it's like, well, no,
well,
of course he is.
I mean, look, there are comic book stores that don't carry Oni books.
Sure.
You know, so, and they don't carry them simply because they're too far back in the Diamond catalog.
Right.
You know, so, yeah, I mean, in that sense, you do cease to exist. But one of the things that, you know, of all people, at the beginning of very early in my career at DC, I went to dinner with Denny O'Neill. Actually, a lunch. It was a lunch with Denny O'Neill and Chuck Dixon. And Chuck was talking about having done some Robin stories and going to a signing and there being a line that just stretched, you know, out of the store and around the block and looped. And whoever he was with said, wow, look at all these people who are here for us. And Chuck's response was, they're not here for us, they're here for him. And I always thought that was actually fairly astute, that at that point, and I think the industry has changed, honestly. I think the industry has changed. And I think where we are now, that line is as much for the creator as for the character.
Sure.
But it is important to remember that, you know, these are never your characters when you're working for a DC or a Marvel. They're not yours. And, you know, you are privileged to get to touch them. You get to give them stories. But they are bigger than you. They exist beyond you. And they don't need you. And a lot of creators, I think, fall into a trap of believing that they do. That these characters do need me. And it harkens back to the Batwoman question. She doesn't need me. You know, she doesn't need me. She will survive. She doesn't need me. And I say that adoring the character and having loved, you know, the opportunity I had to write her and to help create her. But she's part of something much bigger than I will ever be. And, you know, God willing, that's going to endure.
Well, I'll tell you what, we have gone an hour, and I want to address the questions that people have. So for the listening audience, Greg and I already said this before the conversation, that we would wrap up in an hour, and then it sounds like you're up for more talk tomorrow.
Of course.
Well, that's great.
And for you, anything.
I appreciate that, and what we'll do is post
it. And if you come up with anything else you want to talk about, we can talk about that.
There you go.
Maybe by tomorrow I might be able to announce something. I don't know.
Excellent. Yeah, that'd be great, too. And for the purposes of Word Balloon listeners, that'll be our next episode, so be listening for that. Well, I feel like Howie Horowitz at the end of a Batman episode. Same bat time. Same
Nothing
bat
wrong
channel.
With that, man.
No, this is great, man. And I, as always, appreciate your candor. Congratulations on the last run, the Queen and Country novel that is in the stores as we speak. And get out there and pick up the current mission of Tara Chase and see where things will be left hanging as we look forward to the next volume of Queen and Country.
Excellent.
And thanks also for you know what came out this year you know, from DC and Marvel. You know, the Elegy hardcover was fantastic. And I'm glad that it's done as well as it has on the New York Times bestseller list. Well deserved for you and Jim.
Yeah, it was very exciting to see it make it.
Absolutely, man. And we will pick up this conversation in the next episode of Word Balloon.
Excellent.
So there you go. That's part one. Don't worry, more coming on part two. We're going to continue our conversation with Greg and get to some of those great questions that are still waiting. So make sure you listen to the next episode of Word Balloon. Today's episode was brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. They have a wonderful selection of books that you will find at sometimes 38 to 42% off the standard retail price, depending on the publisher. And don't forget, if your orders from InStockTrades.com are $50 or more, your shipping is free. Lots of Queen & Country product from Greg Rucka available at InStockTrades.com. You can get each mission as a separate volume. On a standard retail price like Volume 7, Operation Saddlebags, featuring art from Mike Norton and Steve Ralston, the standard retail price is $14.95, but at InStockTrades.com, $10.47. How about the volumes of the Definitive Edition? There are four of them. The standard retail price for each is $19.95. At InStockTrades.com, just $13.97. Or if you're more interested in the writing process of Greg Rucka, how about the Queen & Country script book? The standard retail price, $15.95 at InStockTrades.com, just $11.97. Don't forget about their sister site, Discount Comic Book Service, DCBService.com, for all your monthly pre-order needs from the Diamond Catalog. You'll find amazing savings there waiting for you at both websites. Check it out for yourself. Go to Discount Comic Book Service at DCBService.com or InStockTrades at InStockTrades.com. John Sutra saying thanks again for listening. Don't forget, Word Balloon is all over the internet. You find us at iFanboy on every Tuesday, where we have a new episode. And, of course, at wordballoon.com, our home site, you'll find our archive there as well, with well over 330 interviews with comic creators, people from animation, film, television. You name it, they're all waiting for you at wordballoon.com. Make sure you subscribe to the iTunes feed if you don't already. And if you do, if you leave us a review or a rating, we certainly would appreciate it. Until next time, thanks again for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2010.